Welcome to the Cashflow Ninja, the podcast sharing how to create and grow income streams and manage, multiply, and protect your wealth in the new economy. Are you tired of trading your time for money? Do you desire freedom today instead of retirement in 10, 20, or 30 years? I'm MC Lobsher, and this is the Cashflow Ninja. Hello, Cashflow Ninjas. MC Lobsher here, and welcome to another episode of the Cashflow Ninja. I have a great show for you today. In today's show, we're going to look at macroeconomic indicators to watch in 2019. My guest in this episode is Richard Duncan. Richard is the author of three books on the global economic crisis. The dollar crisis, causes, consequences, occurs, predicted the current global economic disaster with extraordinary accuracy. It was an international bestseller. His second book was The Corruption of Capitalism, a strategy to rebalance the global economy and restore sustainable growth. And his latest book is The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy. Since the beginning of his career as an equities analyst in Hong Kong in 1986, Richard has served as the global head of investment strategy at ABN AMRO Asset Management in London, worked as a financial sector specialist for the World Bank in Washington, D.C., and headed equity research departments for James Capel Securities and Solomon Brothers in Bangkok. He also worked as a consultant for the IMF in Thailand during the Asia crisis. Richard has appeared frequently on CNBC, CNN, BBC, and Bloomberg Television, as well as on BBC World Service Radio. He has published articles in the Financial Times, the Far East Economic Review, Finance Asia, and CFO Asia. He is also a well-known speaker whose audiences have included the World Economic Forum's East Asia Economic Summit in Singapore, the Euro Finance Conference in Copenhagen, the Chief Financial Officers Roundtable in Shanghai, and the World Knowledge Forum in Seoul. If you're interested in joining our investors group, you could go to cashflowninja.com/investors group and fill out an application form and or email me at info@cashflowninja.com to start the discussion to see if you're a good fit for our group. And if you're in the Philadelphia, Bucks County, and Southern New Jersey area, we are hosting a live investors meetup event every month in Newtown, Pennsylvania. For more information on the monthly event and information on how to join us at our next live event, you could go to cashflowninja.com/events. MC Lobsher, the host of the Cashflow Ninja podcast and also the president and chief wealth and investment strategist of Producers Wealth, where we help our clients integrate cashflow banking, also known as infinite banking, with their business and investments. If you're interested in learning more about how we create strategies that integrate cash flow banking and investments to turbocharge them, you can access a video series at yourownbankingsystem.com. That's yourownbankingsystem.com. Richard, welcome to the show.
MC, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah, very, very excited to have you on. I've been looking forward to this conversation. I'm a huge fan of your work and your books and follow and stay really up to date on what you're discussing and talking about. And I've learned a lot from you in my journey. Richard, for my listeners that's not familiar with you and what you do, can you please share a little bit about your background and journey?
Okay, quickly, I started my career in Hong Kong in 1986. And I've spent most of the time since then moving around in Asia between Hong Kong, Singapore, and Thailand, with a couple of years in Washington at the World Bank and a couple of years in London, where I was global head of investment strategy for ABN AMRO Asset Management. And along the way, I wrote three books on the global economic crisis, the first of which was the dollar crisis, causes, consequences, and cures. But the main benefit I think I had from living in Asia all of these years is that I have seen some extraordinary economic boom and bust cycles in a number of different countries, most notably in Thailand, the Asia crisis, 1997, when Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and South Korea all went into crisis and to some extent had to be bailed out by the IMF. So I had been working in Thailand for 6 years, heading up large research departments for what is now HSBC Securities and also Solomon Brothers, doing research, equity research on all the listed Thai companies. And so I watched Thailand blow into an extraordinary economic bubble during the early 1990s. And that proved to be very valuable because what happened in Thailand during the early 1990s, we've seen that happen again and again around the world as one country after another has been blown into an extraordinary economic bubble because of too much credit creation. And then we've seen those bubbles pop. And then we've seen how the governments have responded to the crises. So I had my education in bubblenomics, as I call it, in Thailand at that point. And it's come in very useful in interpreting what's happened ever since.
What are some of the things, if you can put it down on a couple of points, that you've learned from all of these boom and bust cycles? You've mentioned credit creation that creates the boom. What are some of the things that you see during this boom? What are some of the things that you seem to find very valuable to look at when you've reached the top? And then what is some of the identificators or some of the things that you look at when this thing blows up and the bubbles pop?
Okay, so in all of these cases, all of these bubbles occurred for reasons that would not have been possible before the Bretton Woods system broke down in the early 1970s. That was the international monetary system put in place at the end of World War II to try to replicate the gold standard as best as possible. After that broke down, the global economy started functioning in a very different way than it had before. Very large trade imbalances began to occur. The U.S. started running extraordinarily large trade imbalances. The U.S. trade deficit blew out to 3.5% of GDP in the mid-1980s, and then it blew all the way out to 6% of GDP in 2006. That was $800 billion. And those deficits had to be financed with capital flows. So the larger the deficits became, the larger the capital flows, in this case, into the U.S. became. So what we saw in the post-Bretton Woods era were these extraordinarily large capital flows moving from one country to the other. And as the capital flowed into Thailand, it went into Thailand's banks as deposits. That forced the banks to then lend out those deposits, of course, so they could earn some interest on the loans, so they could pay the interest on the deposits. And this extraordinarily rapid credit growth, this lending growth, the lending growth creates an extraordinary boom, and for a while, everyone enjoys it enormously as asset prices go up and everyone has a job and corporate profits are very good. But after a short while, there's excess capacity of everything, and then the corporations can no longer sell their products, and so they begin defaulting on their bank loans, and the banks fail, and the crisis strikes. And at that point, governments have to intervene and bail them out. So credit creates the boom, and the booms all bust. But what has been most interesting after the crisis of 2008 in the United States is to see the policy response that U.S. policymakers put into place to prevent this extraordinary boom that had occurred in the U.S. leading up to 2008. Which was in fact a global economic bubble. The policy response to that was something that we had not seen before. Extraordinarily large budget deficits financed with extraordinarily large amounts of paper money creation by the U.S. central bank and by central banks all around the world. And that policy response prevented the U.S. economy and the global economy from, we had a great recession, but we would have had a Great Depression that would have still been ongoing. And we probably wouldn't be having this conversation now had it not been for the very large fiscal stimulus programs financed by $3.5 trillion of dollar creation by Ben Bernanke and the Fed. And that effectively reflated the bubble and prevented us from collapsing into a crisis that could have potentially destroyed our civilization.
Now, 10 years later, things are in some ways a little bit different, in some ways very, very similar. What are some of the indicators that you're looking at right now? What are some of the big things that you're paying attention to? Because this is one of the things that I appreciate about you is there's a lot of things that people are not looking at. And if we look at the media, you're not going to hear this or listen to us because most of the media has essentially just become tabloid media, not discussing important things such as this that you get into, Richard. What are some of the things that you're looking at and what we should be paying attention to right now?
Well, the reason that the success of this policy response to the crisis was so surprising and it took everyone by surprise was everyone understood that if central banks created enormous amounts of new money, in this case, the Fed creating $3.5 trillion, everyone had been taught and believed that that kind of paper money creation on that scale would lead to very high rates of inflation that would be extraordinarily destabilizing because high inflation means high interest rates. High interest rates crash the economy. So that didn't happen. We had paper money creation on an absolutely mind-boggling scale, not only in the US, but in Europe, the UK, and Japan, and for that matter, China as well. And we didn't have high rates of inflation. In fact, we've been struggling to prevent deflation most of the last 10 years. So that was something new. People say there's nothing new under the sun, but this was something new. So it's very important for everyone to understand what has changed. And what has changed is globalization. Globalization is extremely deflationary. We no longer have to hire people in Michigan and pay them $200 a day to build an automobile. We can now find people to do that for $10 a day in Western China or Vietnam, not to mention India and Bangladesh. So globalization is so deflationary, it's put such downward pressure on the price of manufactured goods and on wages that those deflationary pressures have completely offset the inflationary pressures that would have resulted from paper money creation on a multi-trillion dollar scale. So what am I watching now? What is the point of all this? The point is, if globalization now breaks down due to trade wars, then we will no longer have these deflationary pressures offsetting the inflationary pressures that will result from the next round of monetary stimulus, which I'm pretty certain is only a matter of time before we see the next round of monetary stimulus. So that globalization, the threat of a trade war, this is the biggest worry on the horizon, as far as I'm concerned.
Let's stay on that topic a little bit. So during the presidential campaign, the last 1 year, President Trump was talking about China and how they're manipulating things. And, he stated that we don't have a good deal with them. What does he mean when he says that? Is there any truth to any of that? What does he talk about them being currency manipulators, and what have they actually done in that respect? And then maybe if you could touch a little bit about the trade war that's going on with China and get into that a little bit and share some more information on that.
Well, by and large, everything that you just mentioned is true. China has been manipulating its currency blatantly for everyone to see, going back a couple of decades. They, according to at least the U.S. corporations, have been demanding technology transfers. They have been protectionist in keeping out U.S. products from Chinese markets. You go to China, you try to Google something, you may not even be able to access Google, and you certainly won't be able to find whatever you're looking for. So they have protected markets, and they have certainly not lived up to the expectations that the West had for them when they joined the WTO. So, yes, they haven't been playing fair. However, the problem is now, at this stage, it's not very easy to reverse this situation that we have. China exports $500 billion of goods to the U.S. every year. The U.S. only exports $130 billion worth of goods to China. So China's trade surplus with the U.S. in 2017 was something like $370 billion. And since 1985, its cumulative trade surplus with the U.S. has been $5 trillion. And that is why China has grown into an economic superpower so quickly. And if they continue with their current strategy, then they're going to very soon overtake the United States as the most, not only as the largest economy in the world, but as the technological superpower of the world, because they have a very focused, government-directed, very investment-driven strategy to invest in new industries and new technologies on the largest scale they can possibly get away with. And if they continue with this for another 5 years, 10 years, then they will be, without doubt, the dominant global superpower. And so suddenly, it's not only President Trump who's concerned, but the U.S. military has woken up to this new reality that they're about to be overtaken in the not-too-distant future by a Chinese technological superpower. So this is not just about trying to balance trade anymore between the U.S. and China. This is more about stopping China's rise. And it's probably going to last beyond President Trump's presidency. So this is a new and in many ways dangerous world that we're entering into. Now, the problem is if we put President Trump campaigned on the promise to put 45% trade tariffs on Chinese goods. Already he has 10% trade tariffs on, I believe, $250 billion or so of Chinese exports to the U.S., with the threat that that's going to go up to 25% on the 1st of March. And higher still, if need be, if China will not conform to his demands, which include not only bringing down the trade balance, but also no longer demanding that foreign corporations transfer their technology to China in exchange for the right to sell their goods in China. So the danger is that if trade tariffs go up to 25%, then that's going to make a whole lot of products in the United States much more expensive than they are now. That's going to cause a dose of inflation in the United States. And if inflation rates go up, then interest rates are going to go up. And the U.S. economy has become very, very dependent on extremely low interest rates. So if interest rates move higher, then first of all, the stock market is going to crash. If they move significantly higher, then the stock prices will move very much lower, and the property prices will also move very much lower. But on top of that, and equally damaging, is if interest rates move higher, then credit is going to contract in the U.S. And credit growth has been driving economic growth in the U.S. for decades. So if credit begins to contract, then that too will throw the U.S. into a very severe recession. So the danger is how do we stop China's rise, or how do we compete with China more effectively without creating a trade war that drives up U.S. interest rates and crashes the U.S. economy? And in addition to that, if we do cause China's economy to go into recession, then that by itself is going to deal a very serious blow to the global economy. And we're seeing that already. The weakness that we're seeing in the global economy all around the world now is to a very large extent because China's economy has slowed down very sharply during the last 18 months or so. And weaker Chinese demand is hurting German exports, Australian exports. There's less money coming out of China for investment elsewhere around the world. And if China goes into recession, it's going to drag the world into recession with it. So these are the challenges we face. If we don't stop China, then they're going to dominate. But if we stop them by putting up trade tariffs and crashing their economy, we're not only going to crash their economy, we're going to crash the U.S. economy and the global economy as well. So it would be, we need to think outside the box, I would argue, and try to find some other solution that will achieve our goals without causing a global severe recession or depression.
Yeah, I'm just thinking the commodity producing countries like Australia, that's relatively close to China, and Indonesia, and then also Brazil will be hit pretty hard with that. And then you've got Germany that sells a lot of capital goods to China. And of course, then all the goods that's being sold to the United States, I mean, will be hit really hard. One of the other things you touched on too is the trade balance between the two countries. Now, does the currency manipulation play into the advantages of this trade imbalance, that China would then purchase the dollar to keep their own currency a little bit more relatively cheaper compared to the US dollar, to then take advantage of that in the global markets?
Yes. So how it works is Chinese exporters sell their goods in the US, they get paid in dollars, they take these dollars back to China. In 2017, they took their $370 billion surplus back to China. These were dollars that they had. Those manufacturers who sold the goods in the US, they wanted to convert that $370 billion into the Chinese currency, the Chinese yuan. But if they'd done that in a free market, then the conversion of so much dollars into yuan would have driven the yuan up to a very high level. And that would have caused Chinese exports to become uncompetitive. So China's exports would have contracted and China's economy would have gone into severe recession. Now, I'm referring to 2017, but in reality, this has been going on for 25 years. So to prevent the currency from appreciating, China's central bank, the People's Bank of China, the PBOC, they buy all of the dollars coming into China at more or less a fixed exchange rate to prevent the currency from appreciating. And we know this because China's foreign exchange reserves rose from almost nothing to $4 trillion at the peak in 2014. Now, so that means whoever brought those dollars into China, the manufacturers, they got to convert their dollars into Chinese yuan and do anything they want with them. What they did, eventually they deposited them into Chinese banks, which caused rapid deposit growth in China. That fueled rapid loan growth in China, and that fueled the economic boom that eventually blew into an extraordinarily large economic bubble. And that's one side of the story. But the side that you ask about is the People's Bank of China. Where did the People's Bank of China get the equivalent of $370 billion worth of yuan in 2017 that they used to buy all of the dollars going into China? Well, the answer is they're a central bank, just like the Fed. They have a magic wand. They can wave it around and they can create money out of thin air. So they created the equivalent of $370 billion and used it to buy those $370 billion coming into China so that China's currency wouldn't appreciate. But it's also important to keep in mind that once the central bank had acquired that $370 billion in that 1 year, they had to do something with those dollars. And what they did with them, of course, they needed to earn a return. And so they invested those dollars into US dollar-denominated assets, like government bonds or Fannie and Freddie bonds or other corporate bonds or stocks. So during this entire past 25 years, as China has accumulated a $5 trillion current account surplus with the United States, they've also, at the peak, they had accumulated $4 trillion of foreign exchange reserves, most of which they invested back into U.S. dollar-denominated assets. And the investment of all of that, of all of those dollars into U.S. dollar-denominated assets is the main reason the U.S. economy blew into a bubble during the early 2000s. From 2004 to 2006, the Fed was worried that the property market in the U.S. was overheating. So they started increasing the U.S. federal funds rate. They increased it from 1% to 5.25% over 24 months. From 1% to 5.25% at the short end of the yield curve, the federal funds rate. But the 10-year bond yields didn't go up despite that Fed tightening. And the reason that the 10-year bond yields didn't go up, the ones that really matter, is because China and other foreign central banks were creating so much of their own money, buying trillions of US dollars, and using those dollars to invest in treasury bonds, which pushed up the price and held down the yield. So that prevented the Fed from, that caused the Fed to lose control over US interest rates. They couldn't make the 10-year bond yield go up, so mortgage rates didn't go up, So the property market blew into an extraordinarily large bubble. And in 2008, it blew up.
You're listening to The Cashflow Ninja, the show helping people all over the world create monthly cash flow and achieve freedom today, not in 10, 20, 30, and or 40 years. This is the show where cash is not king, but cash flow is king. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. My friend Dave Zook says, you can be conventional or you can be wealthy. Pick one. Dave and his team at The Real Asset Investor have syndicated many successful real estate and ATM projects over the last decade. Now his team has an exclusive opportunity for investors in the coal space. Do you want to be part of an energy project that takes conventional coal and cleans it up by extracting liquids while releasing almost zero emissions? The sale of these liquids can produce strong double-digit cash flow and aggressive tax benefits against ordinary income, all while using America's number one most plentiful resource in a responsible, efficient manner. Now that's non-conventional. For more information on this exclusive opportunity, you can visit therealassetinvestor.com or contact the Real Asset Investor team at info@therealassetinvestor.com.
Are you having a hard time finding great investment properties? Unfortunately, the best deals are rarely found locally. Successful investing begins with the right properties in the right markets. Norada Real Estate provides everything you need to invest in the best deals across the United States. Our simple, proven system will help you create real wealth and passive monthly cash flow. Learn how to find the best deals by downloading your free copy of The Ultimate Guide to Passive Real Estate Investing at noradarealestate.com. That's noradarealestate.com.
You're listening to The Cashflow Ninja, the show helping people all over the world create monthly cash flow and achieve freedom today, not in 10, 20, 30, and or 40 years. This is the show where cash is not king, but cash flow is king. Now let's return to our interview. Very interesting. So there's definitely a lot of manipulation going on. Interest rates, you touched that higher interest rates. What would that mean? Driving down the asset prices and then also credit contracting. And then you've also spoken a little bit about the current environment where there's a more of a policy of quantitative tightening versus the easing, the money printing. So it looks like they're no longer printing money, but they're actually destroying it, if you will.
Well, precisely. So U.S. interest rates now should be moving higher. And in fact, they were up until December. The 10-year bond yield rose almost to 3.3%. And that's exactly what should have happened for a number of reasons. First, of course, the Fed was hiking the federal funds rate and steadily making it move higher. But at the same time, the Fed was also conducting quantitative tightening. Now, quantitative tightening is the exact opposite of quantitative easing. With quantitative easing, in three rounds, starting in early 2009, the Fed created $3.5 trillion from thin air, and they used it to buy bonds. And that pushed up mostly government bonds and Fannie and Freddie bonds. So that pushed up the bond prices and that pushed down the bond yields, or in other words, interest rates. So interest rates fell to very low levels, and that was enormously important in stimulating the U.S. economy. And also, it allowed the U.S. government to run multi-trillion dollar budget deficits to stimulate the economy. Over the last 10 years, the budget, the U.S. government debt has increased by something like $11 trillion, which is an increase of something like 175%. Such a large increase in government borrowing wouldn't have been possible if the Fed hadn't been printing money and buying government bonds. Well, so now what they are doing, starting in October 2017, is the Fed is in effect, let's keep this brief, in effect, they are selling bonds. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But they started off reducing their bond holdings by $10 billion a month in October 2017. That went up to $20 billion the next quarter, and then $30 billion the next quarter, $40 billion the next quarter. By the fourth quarter of last year, the Fed was shrinking its balance sheet. In other words, selling government bonds at the rate of $50 billion a month. And so when the Fed sells its bond, it gets paid in cash. And the cash, the Fed doesn't just pile this cash up in some sort of enormous locker somewhere. When the Fed gets the cash back, it just evaporates. It destroys the cash. And so the Fed is now literally destroying $50 trillion a month. And that is $50 trillion a month. I'm sorry, $50 billion a month. Excuse me, $50 billion a month. That is $50 billion a month that is coming out of the financial markets. And so that should be pushing interest rates higher, and it was. And another factor that was pushing U.S. interest rates higher is the U.S. budget deficit. Because of the tax cuts and the increased government spending that Congress enacted more than a year ago now, the U.S. budget deficit has become several hundred billion dollars larger than it was. And when the government borrows more, then that takes money out of the economy and it pushes up interest rates. It crowds out the private sector because interest rates, if the government borrows more and there's only a fixed amount of money, then the cost of money is going to go higher. And so interest rates should be moving higher. And they were up until the beginning of January, really. So in December, the stock market was crashing for two reasons. First, fears of the U.S.-China trade war. And second, because quantitative tightening and increased government borrowing pushed up U.S. interest rates and led people to expect them to move higher. So what happened? Well, first, I think President Trump became quite alarmed that the stock market was falling so much. So he made friendly with China, and he said, we're going to give you three more months. We're not going to push up the trade tariffs from 10% to 25% on January 1st, as he had said. He said, we'll push it back until the beginning of March 1st. And so that provided some relief, and the markets felt that perhaps the trade war would be averted. So the stock market began rallying for that reason. And at the same time, the Fed also became alarmed because the global economy was obviously weakening very rapidly. The stock market was falling very sharply. And if the stock market falls, it destroys wealth. So there'll be less consumption and less economic growth. So the Fed backed off. It revised down its estimates of how many times it would increase interest rates this year. And it also said that it would consider rethinking its strategy of quantitative tightening, of destroying $50 billion a month. And so when the Fed backed down and when Trump backed off the trade war, then first U.S. interest rates fell significantly. The 10-year bond yield started dropping. And the stock market rallied enormously over the last few weeks for those reasons. And now it's interesting that interest rates are remaining low. There's still significant downward pressure on interest rates. They fell from roughly 3.3% on the 10-year government bond yield down to below 2.7%. And there's now downward pressure on interest rates because the global economy is slowing so rapidly. It's slowing because China's economy is weakening much more than the headlines would suggest. And so Europe, the data out of Europe over the last few days has been exceptionally weak. Germany barely avoided a recession in the most recent quarter. So with the global economy weak, there are concerns about where to keep your money safe. And the safest place to keep your money is in U.S. government bonds. That puts upward pressure on the bond prices and puts downward pressure on the bond yields. So the lower interest rates in the U.S. are providing something of a safety valve that is, for the time being, continuing to support the stock market and the property market more than otherwise would be the case. Right now, the stock market is benefiting from, among other things, the very large corporate tax cuts. Corporate tax rate was cut from, 35% to 21%. This was a radical reduction in corporate taxes. And as a result, corporate profits have boomed. But that is all going to fade during this year. And the stimulus that has resulted from those tax cuts will also fade this year. Meanwhile, China's economy looks like it's going to continue weakening because it was in quite dire straits even before this trade war began. So we seem to be heading into a synchronized global slowdown that could turn into something significantly worse than just a slowdown.
You'd mentioned the U.S. dollar strengthening a little bit, and I have family in South Africa and friends and in Australia and friends all over the world. You've been involved a little bit with the IMF and with the World Bank, and there's a lot of dollar loans out there, especially in developing nations. What is the impact going to be for them with this dollar strengthening?
Well, yes. So as long as the Fed carries on destroying $50 billion a month through quantitative tightening, that's $50 billion a month fewer dollars that exist in the world, tightening up liquidity conditions all around the world. And with fewer dollars in existence, all other things remaining the same, then that puts upward pressure on the value of the dollar relative to other currencies. For instance, the Japanese yen. The Bank of Japan is still doing quantitative easing on a very aggressive scale. They're still printing lots of money, the exact opposite now of what the Fed is doing. So the yen should weaken and the dollar should strengthen. So it is almost without fail, whenever the dollar appreciates, commodity prices fall, other factors being the same. If the dollar moves higher, then oil and gold and all the other commodity prices move lower. And when the dollar moves lower, then gold and oil and the other commodity prices move higher. So as long as the Fed continues with its quantitative tightening, then the dollar should continue to strengthen. And that should create a difficult environment for the emerging markets and the commodity producing countries and their economies and their currencies.
So it looks like a little bit of a global slowdown that you're looking at ahead. And then we obviously have a lot of other things going on tying into that. A lot of social trends, populist movements all over the globe. The Brexit crisis, which seems to not go away, but every day there's a new headline on that. What is your take on Brexit? What is your take on some of these movements? Because it all kind of plays into where we started our conversation, globalization. Has that failed? If you look at it from that perspective.
Well, so I think that we need to take a fresh look at where we are. And rather than, you can just imagine, the U.S. economy has been relatively really quite strong in 2018 as a result of the tax cuts and the fiscal stimulus. And still, there's so much discontent in the U.S. and around the world. You mentioned I see perhaps a small slowdown in the global economy. Well, I fear something much more severe than a small slowdown. And if we do have a severe global downturn, you can just imagine the popular discontent that would arise in that kind of environment. Think back to what occurred in the 1930s, for instance. So rather than allowing globalization to break down through increased protectionism and trade wars, I think we should understand that we are now living in a new environment that we haven't experienced before, an environment where globalization is so deflationary that it allows the U.S. government to have extremely large budget deficits and allows the Fed to finance these budget deficits with paper money creation without creating inflation. This is something that's never occurred before. As I said earlier, if the Fed created inflation in the past, if the Fed created too much paper money in the past, it led to very high rates of inflation, which more than offset the benefits that came from the paper money creation in the first place. But now we're in a situation where, as the last 10 years have demonstrated, it is possible for the U.S. government to increase its debt by $11 trillion and have the Fed finance a third of that by creating $3.5 trillion. Buying government bonds without any significant inflation whatsoever. So what this means, I believe, is that rather than crashing the global economy by putting up protectionist trade barriers, if we're concerned that China is going to become the global economic superpower because the Chinese government invests so much in new industries and new technologies, we shouldn't try to stop them by crashing their economy with a trade war. We, the United States, should also invest in new industries and new technologies at the government level on a multi-trillion dollar scale over the next 5 to 10 years, so that we won't be overtaken by China technologically or economically, and that our economy will begin growing at 5% plus annual rates of growth each year, and we can have extraordinary technological breakthroughs, creating technological marvels and medical miracles. Now, I think we should have grand plans, a cancer moonshot, for instance. Over the next 10 years, the U.S. government could afford to invest $1 trillion in genetic engineering research, $1 trillion in biotech, $1 trillion in nanotech, $1 trillion in neurosciences, $1 trillion in green energy. And this investment, just in and of itself, would rev up the economy, making it grow 5% or more a year. And these investments would create technological breakthroughs that would solve many of the world's most pressing problems and cure many of the world's most damaging diseases.
Absolutely. Now, you've mentioned some of its solutions from a macro perspective. A lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs, they're business owners, they're investors. What are some of the things that they can do to position themselves for the coming year in 2019 and this slowdown that you spoke of?
Well, so of course, every investor is in a different financial position, and different strategies are appropriate for different investors and different levels of wealth. For normal individuals without great fortunes, I think one of the most sound investment strategies is to invest in pieces of land with houses on top for rental purposes and rent them out. The reason I emphasize the land is because I don't recommend investing in condominiums. Land is special. There's only a limited amount of it. There will never be any more on this planet. And so in an environment, in an inflationary environment, then gold would go up, but land would also go up for the same reason. If we have a deflationary environment, then the value of land and the value of gold would both fall, but at least you'd still have the rental income from the house. And it's something that you can control. You don't have to worry about some sort of corporate management going rogue or the whole corporation going bankrupt due to some derivative speculation you knew nothing about. This is an investment you can control yourself. You can build up a portfolio of rental properties, and over time, they will provide you a sure and steady income that will give you a very happy retirement.
I like what you just said too, Richard, control, because that's what we speak about quite a bit on the show, is being in control. And having control over your money, your wealth, and also your investments. Now, core message in our show is to leave our families, communities, and the world better than we found it by passing down a mindset of values and principles to future generations, not just money. So if you cannot pass on any money to future generations, and we're only allowed to pass on 3 principles to them to build wealth and achieve happiness and success, what would they be?
That's a big question. For me, as an economist, what I'd like to pass on to other economists and to the general public is, don't be trapped by past ideologies. What I mean by that is, it's important to understand economic history, and it's important to read all the great economists and to understand that economists, for instance, the Austrian economist, brilliant thinkers, they were absolutely spot on for their time, the late 19th century, early 20th century. But that doesn't mean that what they believed is appropriate for our world, where we now have a global economy with at least 2 billion people who will be willing to work for $5 a day, meaning that we're not going to have any inflation for the foreseeable future, for generations, in fact. And so at some points, it's appropriate to learn from Keynesian economic policy. At other points, it's appropriate to learn from Austrian policy. And politically, it's wise also to keep in mind that the French Revolution came about for economic reasons. So Adam Smith is all fine and good, and it's fine for individual entrepreneurs to accumulate billions, but if it goes too far, people might have their heads chopped off. So there has to be a balance, and it's important to draw from different schools of thought and to understand which ones are appropriate for the age that we're living in now. And for some young people today, they may see three cycles through their lifetime in which different schools of thought would be appropriate at that particular point. So be open-minded. Don't be trapped in the ideologies of some dead 19th century economist when it no longer applies to our age. Other pieces of advice I would give is when, at least for young people starting out in their careers, of course, do something that interests you, but also try to do something that other people have not done or that will give you some sort of unique skill and advantage. I was very lucky when I was young, really by accident, I ended up being able to backpack around the world for a year just after university. I hadn't planned to do that, but that happened. So I saw Europe and the Middle East and Southeast Asia. And because I saw Southeast Asia, I recognized it was booming economically. And that's why I've spent my career here. So do try to find an angle that others don't have. And then finally, you asked for three. So I would say, be honest and truthful. If the most important thing is, and try to help your society as well. The most important thing to me, I think, is not racking up billions and billions of dollars, but if you can come up with ideas that will make the world a better place and convey these ideas with a spirit of open-mindedness and integrity and honesty, recognizing and admitting when you are wrong and being open to new ideas, that first and foremost, being truthful so that people will believe you when you say something, and rather than people thinking that you're just out to take their money.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that, Richard. Richard, where can my listeners learn more about you? Where can they stay in touch, and where can they follow you and stay informed of all of the projects that you're involved with, and where can they learn more about MacroWatch?
Okay, so my business now is I have a video newsletter called MacroWatch. Every 2 weeks or so, I upload a new video of me effectively making a PowerPoint presentation discussing something important happening in the global economy and how I believe that's likely to impact the price of stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies, with an emphasis on the importance of credit growth driving economic growth, liquidity provided by central banks being the most important factor driving asset prices, and government policy as it determines credit growth and liquidity. So your listeners can find out more if they visit my website, which is richardduncaneconomics.com, richardduncaneconomics.com. And I'd like to offer them a 50% subscription discount to MacroWatch. If they go to that site and click on the subscribe button, if they use the discount coupon code Ninja, they will receive a 50% discount on their subscription to MacroWatch. So I hope they'll check that out and at the very least sign up for my free blog while they're there.
Fantastic. And thank you so much for making that available. It's very, very generous of you. Richard, appreciate you spending some time with us and coming on the show and sharing your journey and your knowledge and providing so much value for my listeners. This has been fantastic having you on.
Thanks, MC. It's been a pleasure meeting you. Let's do it again sometime.
Life settlement investments have allowed financial and banking institutions to not only buy their equity contractually, but also diversify their capital from any economic, market, and geopolitical risk. It's been part of the billion-dollar blueprint followed by institutional investors. And if you're an accredited investor, you can also now participate in this vehicle with enormous growth potential. You can watch an informational webinar presented by one of the premier organizations providing life settlement investments, Penumbra Solutions, at cashflowninja.com/life settlements.
Thank you again for joining me on the Cashflow Ninja. If you like what you hear and appreciate what we're trying to build here, please subscribe, rate, and write a review for our show on iTunes and share our show with family, friends, and your network. If you're not a subscriber to our newsletter, you can sign up for our newsletter at cashflowninja.com. I want to thank you for spending your most precious resource with me today, your time. Until next time, my friend, live a life of passion and purpose on your terms. This presentation is for educational and informational purposes only. The information being presented and considered does not consider your particular financial objectives or situation, and it does not make personalized recommendations. This material is not intended to replace the advice of a qualified tax and legal advisor or other qualified professionals, and you should not use the information in place of a customized consultation with a licensed professional regarding your specific personal financial objectives, situation, and needs. We believe the information provided is reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy, timeliness, or completeness.